I think Brad has been opening up the other sessions that he's done by reading a prayer from this book by Ted Loader called Gorillas of Grace, and they're beautiful prayers. And this book is available also in the bookstore. It's a wonderful devotional. And this one is called, I Am in Need of What? So let us begin. Well, God, I made it through another sweet, sour time, and here I am, nibbled, frazzled, puzzled, awed, and in need of what? A chuckle, maybe, a revolution begun with a belly laugh, a Bronx cheer in the face of the onslaughts of disaster and death itself. Such is my need, and this is my wonder. Are you really as humorless, as grimly serious as I have made you out to be? Or do aardvarks and monkeys, bullfrogs and platypuses, puppies and porpoises and people, perhaps, reveal the comic side of your grace, the playful side of your love? Tickle me into giggling down the wailing walls of my endless grievances and trip up my waddling pomposities. Lord of laughter as of tears, shake me awake and teach me to laugh at myself, at my black-draped solemnity, over my petty preoccupation with success and failure, through all the hurt and adversity, until my laughter lures me deep beneath the terrors without names, beneath the questions without answers, beneath the pain without relief, lures me deep to the love in me unused, to the strength unspent, to the courage untapped, to the dream unrisked, to the beauty unexpressed, all the way down to the inescapable bottom, to the awareness that I must get on with being who I am as fully as I can, as unflinchingly as I can, as accurately as I can, which is to say, as gracefully, as powerfully, as faithfully as you have created me to be. Amen.
This is also in the library if you don't want to make the investment of whatever it is.
Yeah, $12.95.
Oh, okay, good. Go ahead.
Start?
Yeah.
Well, this session on the parables of Jesus, we're beginning with what we're calling the surprising parables, and we'll be focusing on one of those today. But we thought we would start with a time of brainstorm where you can just throw out the different parables that come to mind when you think of this class. What parables were on your mind as you came in? Just let's name some of those.
Good
Samaritan.
Okay.
Good Samaritan. Okay.
We'll just put them up here so we can look at them. Just, oh, we should
sower, say. Sower in the seed.
Sower in the seed.
Okay. Looking for the gold coin.
Yes, the gold coin, the one where God is imaged as a woman. It's a powerful parable.
Lost coin.
Lost coin,
okay.
The wheat and the tares.
Mm-hmm.
Is sower in the seed the mustard seed?
No, that's different.
No, mustard seed's another one.
The unfaithful.
Okay, the unforgiving servant?
Unfaithful.
The unfaithful servant.
Which one is that?
When he's left in charge of the master's house and sleeps. And is asleep when the thieves come.
What is that one called?
Oh, that's as good as they see. It's interesting. There isn't the same.
I'm reading it now.
Yeah, yeah. Not every parable. That's a good title for that one. Not every parable is known by the same title.
Yeah.
That's just correct. The widow and the shopkeeper. She keeps pestering the shopkeeper about something.
Oh, it's a judge. The widow and the judge.
The judge.
Yeah.
The persistent.
Yeah.
Somebody said prodigal son over there.
Okay, that's a good example. Some people call it the prodigal son. That's how most of us grew up with it, probably. But we also call it the parable of the loving father. So from which angle?
No, it's the parable of the elder brother.
Oh, right.
That's good.
There's also a parable I find difficult to understand.
Mm-hmm.
The parable of the lost sheep. That's the one about the servant who... who is charged with not taking care of the master's possessions, and he goes out and he
cuts deals with the creditors.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
the dishonest steward.
And he winds up throttling somebody because they're not paying him. And
the unforgiving servant.
Is that the unforgiving servant? Okay.
the other one really.
Yeah, the other one is disturbing as well. The dishonest steward.
We'll be talking about that one on Saturday.
Steward. Yeah.
Yeah.
The, is that the same one where someone one invests and one buries the money?
No.
Oh, we called that the parable of the talents. Is that? Yeah, it's fun to brainstorm because we get a sense of.
All right.
What about the
talents?
The one with the I'm known as centurion. The demons in the tombs, and they go into the pigs.
That's a healing
That's
story,
a
but
healing
not a
story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a true to life
wedding.
Oh, the wedding feast. Yes.
Actually, there are a couple of versions of that, but. The wedding feast in Matthew 25, I think it is probably what we're thinking of.
I think so.
About the people who were invited to put on the wedding garments, and one guy doesn't have one, and so the bouncer comes. How'd you go? Because you didn't put it on.
Yeah,
oh, yeah, the wise and foolish virgins with the oil. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maidens. Wise and foolish maidens. All right.
Okay.
Not bad.
That's pretty good.
Anybody else?
Class in itself.
That's about the odds, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
But nobody's mentioned the one that we plan to talk about today.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's surprising.
Right, that's surprising.
The laborers in the vineyard.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah. And the other one about.
Or it's called the parable of the gracious employer.
Yeah, but you're thinking of a different vineyard parable about the planting of the vineyard, and the servants are sent to check in, and then finally the son is sent. And mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. The wicked tenants.
The wicked, yeah. The wicked tenants.
The one where he gets
paid. Yeah.
The laborers, is that the one where the ones who come late get paid as much as the ones who get there first? I don't like that one.
That's why we're focusing on it.
Good. All right. Anybody else? Take all suggestions. That's not bad.
That's pretty good, Liz. Gosh.
Have we had the ones you're talking about yet?
We
for today.
Right here.
Okay.
Today we're just going to talk about one parable because we want to do some introductory things too, part of which was get all this in front of ourselves. But in the other two sessions we do, we'll do two parables at a time. Oh, I know another one I forgot, which we'll be doing. The rich man and Lazarus.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Right. Not bad. I should do another couple little commercials here. These are in the library.
That's the same book, I think, isn't it?
No, this is different. This is a newer book. But yeah, this is the most important. Joachim Jeremias, The Parables of Jesus, is a very good, thorough book. And if you look in the back, he's got a nice index to give you a great rundown on all the parables in the New Testament that he treats in this book, which is most of them. So, if you're interested, check those out. Okay, where are we? Oh, well, maybe a few thoughts on why parables then? Why does Jesus teach in parables, and why do we spend so much time trying to figure out what Jesus was saying when he did speak in parables? One way to say that might be that Jesus did not want to communicate with words. Jesus wanted to communicate with people. I always try to remind Sunday school teachers that you're not teaching curriculum, you're teaching children, which is an important distinction to keep in mind. But in every parable, although they are quite different, and we'll be talking about some of the different styles and interpretations of the parables, there are always at least these three elements. You've always got the teller of the parable, who is Jesus. You've always got the narrative or the story itself, the parable proper. And then you've always got the hearers. All parables were told orally. People heard them. They were not something that were written down for, you know, private consumption as you sat alone in your room to read. Parables were experienced So they set up a dynamic encounter between Jesus and his listeners. What's really interesting about parables in the New Testament is to observe often what the reaction is on the part of those who hear Jesus. It frequently is not a pleasant encounter that happens.
Well, and a lot of times they're heard and they're overheard.
Yes.
So they're addressed to the disciples, for instance, but then in the context where the Pharisees can hear them.
Yeah. So it's direct and kind of indirect discourse, which is an interesting teaching style when you think about it. Jesus is not simply didactically laying out points 1, 2, 3, subpoint A, B, whatever, but doing whatever is needed in order to draw people into the experience. We talked in the sessions I was doing on shame, we talked a lot about the human predicament, what are we as human beings, and I guess one basic thing you could say about us as human beings is that we are lost. We are somehow estranged. We are out of relationship. And so one of the things that the parables offer is a chance to try to find ourselves in this story. Who is it that we identify with? Do we see a new understanding here of God? Do we find ourselves in the context of God in a new way somehow? Well, the main point, though, a lot of energy has been invested over the years in trying to interpret the parables. Most all of these books about parables are trying to give you a good interpretation. We'll be trying to do that. Every sermon you've ever heard on parables has tried to do that. But the point I think that we've come to is that more than us interpreting the parable, what Jesus really wants is for the parable to interpret us. That's why these stories are often so disturbing to the people who hear them. And they walk away saying, they take up stones as if to kill him, and he's able to slide away through the crowd, etc. That's what we want to try to have happen here, is that we hear these stories in a new way so that they interpret us, and we see ourselves in a new light because of them. It's a little bit, this was a little description, I think, that was in John and Mary Schramm's book, some of you may have read, The Things That Make for Peace. It's a woman in an art museum, and she's standing in front of this absolutely priceless painting, although she's not really aware of what she's looking at. And she stands there and says, I don't see what's so great about it. And the custodian or the person, who's standing, kind of keeping guard and watch over the paintings, approaches her and says, well, madam, the painting is not on trial here. You are. So, it's not just that we evaluate the parable and say, well, what's the point? Well, the point is that we are the point. The story is there to interpret us. We are, in some ways, assessed and evaluated by our reaction to the story, I guess we could say.
And if maybe ahead,
if let me erase this stuff.
Okay, if parables do anything for us, they flip our expectations. They set our world a kilter. They set us a kilter. That's the unnerving part about the laborers in the vineyard parable that we're going to be talking about today. They challenge our way of looking at the world. And they challenged the early disciples' way, they challenged, obviously, the religious establishment's way, and they challenge our way today. And I was thinking about the man who spoke and gave the brief, is it Matins this morning at breakfast time, mm-hmm. talked about, as he put it, the paradoxical way that what created Holden Village initially was something against the environment, and now look at the place that exists today. And we can see that paradoxically, parabolically, in a way, that has reversed expectations as well. So we thought that we would illustrate to you using the story of Jonah, the familiar Old Testament story of Jonah, as an example of how expectations are reversed. And this comes from the work of this fellow, John Dominic Crossan.
New Testament scholar.
New Testament scholar, right. And so So what he does is he sets up these expectations. And when we look at the story of Jonah, there's a prophet. And you expect a prophet to obey God, right? I mean, that's the expectation that we bring to this story. That Jonah will be in obedience to the living God. And then the other expectation is that a pagan, right, Nineveh, will not obey, will disobey God. So our expectations, the expectations that we bring to the text itself are these. But what happens in the context of the story of Jonah is that we get, as he would say, all crossed up, right? What happens is that the prophet is the one who disobeys, and the pagans are the ones who obey. In other words, it's the world isn't like we think it is, and it kind of opens a window, hopefully.
Yeah, and that's a the Jonah story has all of the classic features of parable. So this story style is not necessarily totally unique to Jesus, although Jesus certainly develops it to a new level and uses it very skillfully. But the Jonah story is a good example of this kind of reversal of expectations, how it doesn't, the plot doesn't flow the way you think. The Good Samaritan is something like that too, where no one would have expected that this would be the person to help, since everybody thought the Samaritans were the most despised and so forth. When you think about it along those lines, I mean, that diagram is kind of simple, but just let that sink in for a minute. That's why often we find people who hear Jesus' parables come away shaking their heads, saying things like, you know, I'm not exactly sure I know what he's saying, but I don't think I like it. I think he's talking about me. Remember how upset Jonah is in the story. It's unnerving to think that the people who don't believe will be the ones who obey, while the one who ostensibly believes is the one who disobeys. You know, it's unsettling to your view of the world. All of a sudden, Jesus is telling parables, is challenging us to see things, you know, in an amazingly different way. But not the only way to interpret these, right?
Right.
Okay.
We thought that we'd look a little bit back in history, and we would give a feeling for how the parables have been interpreted. And one of the most common ways that the parables have been interpreted is the use of allegory, which is kind of the one-to-one correspondence on what the meanings might be. And some of the parables actually do function as allegories, and so that kind of correspondence can work. And the one that comes to mind is the one that you suggested, the parable of the vineyard or the wicked tenants. When you think about the man plants a vineyard and he sends these three servants to come and get the fruit from it, and each of them beat up the tenant, and finally he sends his own son and the son is killed. And then what happens? The owner of the vineyard will come back and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. And so the interpretation in an allegorical form is that God is the owner, and that the tenants are Israel, right? And that the servants are the prophets who have come, and finally the son is Jesus, and the tenants are the Gentiles. So that kind of allegorical form has been one that's been a common interpretation. The problem is that early on, the tendency was to interpret many of the parables, all of the parables, in an allegorical style. And one of the styles, one of the interpretations of the Good Samaritan, for instance, in an allegorical style is really fascinating, and it takes some mental agility, so hang on here.
This was Origen,
This was
right?
Origen who interpreted it this way. And what he, you know the story of the Good Samaritan, what he said was
remind us who Origen was.
We
know church history better.
Second century, yeah, third century.
Like ancient church father.
Out of the Greek tradition in Alexandria, I think.
Okay.
Anyway, the allegorical interpretation really fit in his perspective. So the man who comes down is Adam. And he's coming down from Jerusalem, or heaven. And he comes down into Jericho, which is the world. And robbers, who are the devil, right, beat him up and leave him there to die. And then who comes by? First one is the priest, who is the law, walks right on by. Second one comes? The Levite, right? The prophets, they walk on by. Then comes the Samaritan. Who might that be?
Just a person.
Jesus, right.
Everything's then very symbolic.
Then comes the Samaritan. Jesus walks by, takes him to the inn, which is the church. See, this is where it gets a little, you start thinking, oh, gee. Pays two denarii, which to origin represented the father and the son, right? And then promises to come back, which is the second coming, right? So he constructs this enormous allegory with these pieces that fit. And part of what this does is it distances us from what might be the deeper or the more unsettling truth of that story.
It's a very cognitive, reasoned, intellectual kind of approach to things, which I have a little trouble envisioning Jesus telling.
You need a pen to make the lines connect.
You need a little laptop computer to figure that out. Well, we want to push into what some have called the true parable form. Now, that's a little, put that in quotes, but by true parable, meaning this idea of reversal of expectations, subversion of worldview. Although there are some stories that function as allegories, many operate in this truly parabolic way that unnerves and subverts and upsets and gives us a new perspective on things. So let's, if you're close to a Bible, take a look in Matthew chapter 20. And this is the story of the laborers in the vineyard. Matthew chapter 20, starting at the first verse through the 15th verse. Let's see, we got a volunteer who likes to read, who would want to read this for us. You're all shy, Mike. Go ahead.
For the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, "You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right I will give to you." So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, "Why do you stand here idle all day?" They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You go into the vineyard too." And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, "Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first." And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the householder, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day in the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I chose to give to this last as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity?"
Okay, and we'll stop right there. Even though the paragraph includes verse 16, most New Testament scholars conclude that that's Matthew choosing to make a comment there about the parable and not actually part of what Jesus said as the story. I mean, it may be a very accurate interpretation, but we want to try to stick with what was probably the parable as originally told. Do y'all know who Garrison Keillor is, or have some nodding acquaintance, I assume? I remember he commented.
I live near him.
Yeah. I remember him saying once that Pastor Ingquist was always very reluctant to preach on this parable because this business about the last being first and the first last kind of created the impression that you could sleep through the most of the sermon, but if you woke up at the right at the end and you could catch the point and everything would be okay. Didn't want to set up that expectation for people. Let's see. Probably important to know. Do you understand about the first hour, the third hour, the sixth hour, the ninth hour, and so forth? The time was marked from what we call 6 in the morning, sunup, basically, was the first hour. So the sixth hour is noon, and the ninth hour is 3, and the 11th hour, as we sometimes use that phrase, you know, it slipped in at the 11th hour, is 5 in the afternoon, and then 6 o'clock would be like quitting time, and that's when everybody gets paid for their day's work. Well, notice how, in the way that this parable is told, Jesus goes out of his way almost to avoid having this be a moral parable or an allegorical parable that you say, and so the moral of the story, kids, is thus and so. The owner is not moral. I mean, he does not pay those who have worked all day more than the ones who show up, you know, at the last hour. And the point is not really that the owner is especially generous, because he's not really especially generous. I mean, if he were really generous, some would get more. And so the point is the owner simply violates everybody's expectations. These people are agitated at the end, saying, wait, we didn't get what we have coming to us. Kind of reminds you of the older brother in the Good Samaritan parable who says, I've been here the whole time doing everything you wanted me to do, and now I don't. And remember, the father says, everything I have is yours. Why do you begrudge me giving to your brother? Well, but he came in at the last, well, nonetheless.
Yeah, but if we were in a strawberry patch, you might be eating strawberries while he's...
Yeah, they got paid more than they deserved. We don't know what kind of work they were doing. A couple, and Irenaeus is one of them, commentators on this parable point out that Jesus very likely directed this parable at his opponents, the Pharisees in this case, as if to say, okay, you people follow the straight and narrow, you know, and you get rewarded according to your expectations. On the other hand, these sinners that I eat with repent, and they are also welcomed into the kingdom. You know, you'll get what you expect, but I'm giving to them what they may not expect. That does not mean that you are less a part of the kingdom, you know, if you've worked faithfully and follow the rules. But it doesn't make these people who I choose to invite in at the last moment any less a part of the kingdom either. It's just that when you stop to think about the way that the Pharisees often respond to Jesus' teaching, by their own response, they may well be excluding themselves from the kingdom because of the way that they begrudge. I mean, their spirit hardly befits what we think of as a kingdom spirit, you know, begrudging what Jesus is willing and able to do. A.M. Hunter, who has a nice book on the parables, puts it, sort of paraphrases what Jesus is saying this way, or what the owner of the vineyard is saying. Friend, I am not swindling you. You are getting what we agreed on. Must I be mean to these unfortunates because you are envious? No? Yeah, maybe cast it in a different light. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm running out of ideas.
Another interpretation has talked about it from the liberation theology point of view. That is the point of view that God has a preferential option for the poor, that God is on the side of the oppressed, and says that that this is the expression of God's sympathy for those who've waited all day and who haven't been hired. And Brad and I are from Southern California, and we live in San Diego, which is right near the border, and many of you probably in your own homes see day laborers waiting out on the side of the road, and waiting to be picked up. There's, in fact, the corner near where we used to live, there's a whole group of guys who would hang out there on the corner and wait, and it was kind of, I mean, as luck would have it, they'd either wait all day or maybe they'd get some work, but there's this sense that God, in the parable at least, that God is going to take care of those people who are the day laborers, who haven't got the work and who are waiting. Maybe maybe the care will come in the future. Maybe the care isn't, you know, today, but the sense of the promise being there on these people's behalf.
So it can be seen as an eschatological mm-hmm. parable, a message of the end time, the fullness of time of what God will do. Some work faithfully right on through, others don't have that chance, but God is there to take care of all. Well, it perhaps you can begin to see that this has a bit of a disturbing interpretation for us. Those workers who are grumbling at the end of the story and are dissatisfied, they experience some threat out of all this, I think. But, okay, we've laid this story out in front of us now. We've let it kind of wash over us and think about it. Wondering where you are at this point, as you're hearing this message, how do you receive what it is that Jesus may be trying to speak through this in terms of your own life and situation? Where do you begin to find yourself in this parable?
I found myself crumbling at first, and then it was making me rethink why I was serving Jesus, or how I came to him, and how I came to him was just like those 11th hour people in the first place, you know. And then all those years I had the joy of serving. And am I, you know, and am I in the joy of serving Jesus now, or am I in the rich and little rules that he never wanted me to be in, you know? Mm-hmm. So it really pulled me out and made me think why I was here and who I was serving and how many years I'd had of loving mm-hmm. and treating
yeah. mm-hmm. Others, anybody?
It reminded me that God's kingdom is open to everybody, no matter what hour it is.
Yeah.
I'm giving the shaft again.
Yeah.
Say more.
Well, I'm going up 0 day, you know? And I thought I could put my trust there, and I still can't trust him.
Hmm.
Because he's not fair.
That's right.
He's the fairness.
That's right.
Right. And then you're left to ask, and according to whose understanding of yeah. fairness
mm-hmm.
am I going to choose to operate? That's right. In one sense, this is unfair. And yet, remember, the those who work all day do not get less than what they were promised at the beginning. Their wages do not go down because the others get the full day's pay. They get...
But he changed the rule.
The sense is that there's a piece of pie, or there's a pie, and the people come out in the first hour and they think, you know, they're going to get a piece of pie, and they're afraid that at the people who come at the 11th hour are going to get a piece of pie that's equal to their piece of pie, so that makes their piece of pie smaller.
Yeah.
Well, God's kingdom, heaven, is an enormously large piece of pie. We can't conceive of how large it is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's plenty for all.
And it's typical, well, you should say more about typical male thinking, right? To think there's not enough to go
around.
There's
not enough, yeah. Right, scarcity. I just had this image, you know, the Holden bakery or whatever, you know, that you have this image, there's one pie, and suddenly out come, you know, five dozen more pies, and everyone gets pie, and then,
yeah.
Right.
But isn't this the case with what some of the feminist theologians have been pointing out, that men often tend to think in this, you know, I got to get mine because there's not enough to go around,
mm-hmm.
and there's another way to look, I mean, this is very stereotypical, but the other way to look at things, which is I can win and you can, am
well,
I
if there's
that
a,
right?
If there's a hierarchy and a pinnacle, there's one point on top and only one person can be there, but if there's a sense of we can share our power, or we can, right, we can be in a circle, then a lot of people can be in.
Yeah, what's that called, dancing the...
Yeah, Sarah's Circle or Jacob's Ladder.
Right.
Yeah, climb to the top or be together.
It's a win-win or a win-lose situation.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
If you win, then I must lose, right? Okay. Let's see. Let's go back here and then around.
Well, leading off from that idea, there can be a wonderful sense of relief that you don't have to work so hard anymore. And maybe the next day, maybe I'll show up at noon, you know.
We'll take advantage of this.
Or just takes a lot of pressure off of people.
There's some grace.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That sounds
mad because you know you
sounds to me like what I've heard. Do I want to be a pigeon or do I want to be a statue?
And there's a certain place where this isn't an allegory, so we can't press it into the economic world 100%, you know.
Right.
But
right.
It's funny. Did you have
let's go,
can we call this can we talk about it? Like God's equality and God treats us all equally. Can we think of it as showing God's equality in his treatment? Treating us that way?
It's not equal.
Well, that's a good question. Now, that's a good question. You say, is God being equal or unequal, if we understand that God is somehow in the role of the owner here? Is this equal treatment or is it unequal treatment that those 11th hour people get the same wage as the others?
That's the question.
I don't know. That's the question.
But it's God's way. It's God's way, and we may not think that it's equal, but it is. We have to think of it differently.
It's like the thief on the cross.
Ah, the 11th hour thief on the cross, right. Let's see, the comment in the back here, though, please.
Well, what about the possibility of the, I think maybe in this particular case, we make it too much a matter of, say, physical labor, whereas it might be symbolic of something that, for example, being accepted for or paid for physical labor might have a completely different implication than if you are talking about someone who comes into an ideational or spiritual or the word concept. If you come into an ideational situation late and your ideas correspond to others, I mean, you could be accepted the same as somebody that had been there for a year.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I studied so long and so hard. Yeah. Kurt.
I just want to make the observation when we look at it from being set up from the world's point of view, in terms of the fairness and the justice and the of it all, and the, how it does get switched around. And recently this summer, for me, that happened with in the Olympics. It was really fun to see a little glimpse about the basketball team, the dream team thing, and our expectations as Americans going in with the dream team, we're going to trounce everybody, we're going to win. And getting the news reports back from the teams that they were going to play, and all these little countries, and all these basketball players from around the world that knew they were going to get just whipped on the floor, but were just delighted to be able to play these people. Mm-hmm. They were excited to just be able to be there, the presence of these great basketball players. And they knew they'd lose. So that was, for me, that was a flip of whole reversal of expectations. And then that got me thinking about all the athletes that train and train and train and train and train and go to the Olympics knowing they're going to come in 30th place. I mean, they know that. They know who the stars are. And they show up anyway, and that was...
But they're still in. It isn't a matter of so much what their status is and get in, but get into the door.
Yeah.
The kingdom.
Because, I focus on the gold medals and stuff. I mean, I watched all that. I got cable hooked up just so I could watch. I wanted to see who's going to win. But there's just so many athletes who don't get... who are there just because they want to be there. Are just happy to be competing and knowing they're going to lose in the way the world sets up winning and losing. So,
Yeah.
Still happens.
I, well, let's see, Mike, go ahead. Please.
This parable brought in me visions of the annual meeting. Where the guy who's been in the congregation and all the committees for years and years gets listened to attentively, and the relatively new member doesn't. Mm.
Oh, or sending out.
Yeah.
What can?
I experience that sometimes. The new whippersnapper just pops up with this idea off the wall, and suddenly people say, yeah, why don't we do that? And I've been plugging that for 5 years, and nobody would listen to me, you know? But now all of a sudden, the person who comes the 11th hour gets the attention. I mean, it does cut.
Can you grumble?
Oh, boy, do I grumble. Yeah.
Not there.
You know, I did a little autobiographical moment here. When I started into ministry, I was in a team ministry, and that went for 2 years, and then my colleague left to take another position, and then the church called me to stay on. But his departure was a very difficult moment for me, because at his departure, the congregation gifted him with a very large sum of money. It was about equal to 1 year's salary for me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this is... I just had a lot of trouble.
Big time.
Yeah. And I then caught myself later saying, no, wait a minute. You know, I got exactly what was promised to me. The covenant was that, you know, my salary would be this. The treasurer has never failed to write my check on time. My compensation has always been there. I agreed to that. I have really no complaint. I mean, if they chose to be generous with him at his departure, for reasons, frankly, that were beyond me. But, you know, I mean, when I finally got that into perspective, I realized how small-minded I was being, you know. No, it may be to some extent, but I really think for a number of people, it was a true gesture of generosity that, you know, they wanted to gift him with that. And you know, my framework said, unfair, not right, unequal, you know, I've worked just as hard, I get no bonus, blah, blah, blah. But the point was, I had been adequately taken care of with all that had been agreed to. And there was not less for me just because others wanted to be generous and there was more for him. So that brought this home to me in a different way. There was a hand, yeah.
Well, in a smaller church, if the person comes in at the 11th hour, a lot of times, if they show any interest whatsoever, they can end up with the whole shebang.
Yeah.
Right. You want to be congregational president? Fine. Exactly. Well, there is something in this story, I think, that can be very unsettling. I was remembering talking with a fellow in our congregation who, he died about 3 years ago now, but not long before he died, I had a conversation with him. He was quite depressed. He had recently retired and was finding this to be a very difficult experience. His whole life, he had worked for a company delivering milk. He had been a milkman. And he had gotten up 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning every day of his working life to do this milk route. Physical labor, very demanding, and he was very faithful. He was very seldom sick, and he was extremely responsible. But I remember him saying, I don't get it. You know, I was, when I reached the age, they retired me. I got no status out of that. Nobody seemed to appreciate all those years I put in doing what I did. And he said, now I don't really know, you know, kind of what I'm supposed to be doing in my retirement. There was this sense, I think, that what was eating at him was, I really was not able to provide for my own security, you know, no matter what. I mean, he had saved for retirement and all that, but in terms of his psychological well-being, that he could not provide for, that all of the years of hard work, you know, didn't take care of. You know, there's something in this parable, perhaps, that says to us that we are not rewarded on the basis of what we do, but rather on the basis of someone else's generosity, which means that if I'm a person who likes to be in control, which I'm not, am I?
No.
No. then I'm unnerved by this, because my sense of being able to provide for myself is pretty seriously challenged by this idea. But maybe that's the only way Jesus can get people opened up to seeing what the kingdom is all about. That you must renounce what you have, take up your cross and follow. Give up these attachments you have to possessions and the baggage and so forth. I don't know, it's partly what it means to me, anyway. Please, yeah.
I think whenever I read this, that it reminds me that my perspective isn't God's perspective, mm-hmm. and that we always want to play God and make the rules, when it's really God, it's His choice here on what He pays, and that we won't, you know, we will need to let God be God, and that if He says that this, you know, we don't always understand the whole picture. Yeah. And sometimes His perspective isn't ours, and just to allow to trust that is the hard thing to do.
Mm. But see, it would be very unnerving if at the end the owner said, "Now I'm going to choose to give these who came last double what you got for working all day." Now that would be a real serious. Then we'd have to ask more questions. Is this really fairness? But what's interesting to me is we hear this and just. Almost automatically, we jump to the conclusion that in fact is what is happening until we catch ourselves and say, no, in fact, everybody's getting the same. It's not they're getting less and they're getting more. Everybody's getting the same. But yeah, we tend to hear it first as, somebody is playing with the rules when, in fact, God is free to do what God wants. And what God apparently wants is equality, you know, everybody gets treated the same. But it's this reverse switching around business, I think. Yeah.
Well, you don't know who you are anymore. I think we're so set up to know who we are. Our own identities are so lodged in what we make or how we're rewarded that when someone else is rewarded the same amount of us and we know we did a different amount of work, it's just very unnerving. And somehow we know who we are when other people stay in their places too.
Right, right.
Or it could be that we're so set in our ideas, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't want to just make an economic business happen.
But God's grace is the same for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe it isn't talking about salvation. When I think about it that way, then I think God wants everybody to be saved, whether or not they were there all 11 hours, and the last one who came in only heard about Him the last hour, but He has the same chance. Everybody should have the same chance. I don't know if He's talking about salvation or not here.
On that point, let me invite you to take a look at verse 14. See what you think about this. Notice the owner says to those who have worked all day, take what belongs to you and go. Jeremias, I believe it was, who, among others, suggested that this is a kind of dismissal, a way of saying you will not be invited back here. You have excluded yourself, because that's the attitude you have brought to this, that you're going to complain because it's somehow unfair. That's not an attitude fitting for work in this place. A kind of sending out, a dismissal. I don't know, does that strike you as being a fair reading of this, or maybe not? I'm throwing that out as a possibility, a way that
sure,
some have interpreted.
Yeah, sure, right.
Okay, I'm going.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if grace is the same for everybody, and I worked all day.
I don't need this.
Yeah.
Not going to work in that vineyard anymore.
I'll work for somebody that plays fair and change the rules.
Yeah. So we don't know, but what they may go stand in the unemployment line then for a long time. If they may not get anything. Who knows? Who had a comment? Yeah.
The worry that impresses me is choose. God chooses to do this. And He is the boss, and you do not bring in your union or anything else. It's God's land.
That's great. The people of God should unionize. It's a fair treatment. Right.
But we might really get it. There will be a real trouble.
Isn't that, you know, have any of you... Huh?
And actually, in that terms of that, that was what was happening to the nation of Israel. Yeah. They had unionized.
The religious establishment. Yeah. That's good. And that was...
Go ahead.
I was thinking, too, about the moral judgment that I have, that I label on the 11th hour people in terms of workers and the laziness of them, to be available that way. You know, they should have had jobs at 6, like I did. So I keep thinking about the flip-flopping of expectations that it's not just that they came in and did less work, but I know that I put on this the moral judgment of being lazy.
Yeah, but they were standing there all day. I mean, it wasn't their fault that we hired them.
Well,
I'm
not except that there's something wrong about people.
I'm not sure there's really. They haven't been organized enough to go, fill out the resume and get a job.
Outside of California.
It does say in verse 6 that the owner says, why do you stand here idle all day? And they said, because no one has hired us. As if to say they had been there hoping to be a part. But see, that can also become for us a justification. And then we say, well, okay, I mean, it's all right then because they were as earnest as everyone else. Well, but would not the owner or God be just as justified even if they hadn't been standing there all day trying to get hired, to say, I want you now, please come. Because there are these other parables about the feast and so forth, where they go out and beat the highways and hedges people who had, you know, no interest in coming, and at the last minute get dragged in without really a clue. So the parables begin to have to interpret each other in some sense.
I'm just wondering, is the Billy Graham Crusade a medium for those at the 11th hour, those to go to the vineyard? This 11th hour up here, you've only got 1 hour left.
You lost me there somehow. Say that again.
I'm thinking that with the Billy Graham Crusade, he the medium whereby only those who come in at the 11th hour now have the chance to have the kingdom?
I don't know. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think that's so, although I understand that some of the people who go there and be converted, and they walk out of there and they lose it a few days later. That's possible.
Sure.
And I think studies show that the majority of people who come down and have that conversion experience at his rallies or whatever are people who are kind of recommitting, who have had some experience in the past and who are in large part saying, okay, I'm going to have a faith recommitment.
Yeah.
So it's like welcome back to the vineyard rather than...
We need to wrap up here, take us toward the conclusion.
You know, it seems it's kind of a normal human, maybe because we're in the context of church, to response for us to identify with the people who've been working the whole day, right? I mean, I think we all connect at that level. Yeah, I was there at 6 a.m. and I worked this whole time. But there's a...
Pastors never think that.
But there's incredibly good news in this for someone who came in at the 11th hour. I mean, think of it from the perspective of the person who came in during the middle of the day or at the end of the day, the sense that that there's always time, that there is a new, there's a place for you, that, as Yogi Berra put it, it ain't over till it's over. And as a pastor in our community, a Methodist pastor put it, it ain't over till God says it's over. You know, I mean, the way that we perceive the way things are and the way that God perceives things, as Paula said, there's a gap. So there's this joyous experience for those people who haven't worked all day.
You know, the only way that this is irritating is if you are comparing yourself with everyone else.
That's right.
We're not called to compare ourselves to everyone else. We're just responsible to God, as these workers were responsible to the owner of the vineyard, and not to anyone else. And to heck with what happens to them. Their responsibility is to God, too, or to the landowner. And we shouldn't be worried about other people and what they're doing.
That's true. That's often how we claim our identity, is in relation to
you.
But that's the whole point, though, is that that's not where we should claim our identity. And identity is our perspective. How
if
God
has gifted you with an identity in baptism as a member of the kingdom, this is the... We got to...
If you look at it from the point of view of the people who were coming in last, and from the point of view of the success of the church in the long run, what success would the church have had if it appeared that people that came in late were going to get lower and lower down on the totem pole?
Would not be a very good enterprise, would it? Well, we're just at out of time. Let me end with this thought, that the parables, I think, of Jesus, and certainly this is the point that we want to try to press toward, is that in one way or another, they point us toward the cross. One person has said that Jesus himself is God's parable, the unexpected reversal of expectations. The very fact that Jesus comes as the kind of Messiah that Jesus is, subverting all the expectations of the community of what messianic meant. Jesus is parable incarnate, in a sense. So we're going to try to carry that through. If you have time and can come back tomorrow, we're going to talk about, what is it tomorrow? Good guys and bad guys.
Good guy, bad guy.
The parable of the Good Samaritan. Although, who's the real good guy in that story, right? Who do you expect it would be the good guy? And the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. Okay, so we'll take on two parables tomorrow, 10:45, same time, same place. And thanks for coming.
Those are in Luke 10 and Luke 16.
You can do your homework.
Christmas is coming.
No. Okay.
Do you know Robert Capon's version of this?
Have you read that?
Capon's
version. He does the warning, picking the grapes, and the storm is coming in. And he has Robert Mondavi. And Mondavi goes out and he goes, like, you know, I got to get the grapes in. So he washes out and gets these people coming in. And it's like, the harvest is coming in. It's the best harvest ever. He goes out and the storm's still coming in to get it fast. He gets out some more workers, some more. By the end of the day, he runs out and it's just the dregs. It's the guys and the girls in leather listening to music and smoking cigarettes in the town center. And he gets them. And they're smoking beer or drinking beer and stuff, and he brings them in. And then he said such a good haul that he just
splits it all.
He just says he runs up to the teller and says, Let me do it. And he does it, tells the whole story with a girl who's got the stringy hair and all that and a halter top, whatever. And she's walking away and she's counting her money. And she says, oh, this must be a mistake. And then he goes into human nature and says, does she go back and
God.
No, she keeps on walking. It tells her friends, who convince her they should go back and then gloat over the other people. But then when the people in the back of the line find out how much the people, he says, human nature kicks in again, and they start doing mathematics to figure out if the people who came in last get a whole day's wage all get six times. So they get to that. They get to
so
their
expectations.
Expectations are just...
And they give up the contract. Yeah.
Is this in his book, Parables of Grace?
I'm going to go get the boy.
We have
the king.
You stay here. It's okay.
But anyway,
because it's good to talk.
I've read a number of his things, but not all.
He doesn't do all of them. He doesn't do them all that way.
Yeah.
But this particular parable.
I got to look that up. I've got that at home.